Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the 10th day of protests in Egypt, chaos in Cairo and beyond, clashes between pro-Mubarak supporters and protesters growing more violent, the U.S., the U.N., pulling people out, and a whole great era of American foreign policy on the line, maybe gone already. There are large strategic interests in this region and a whole raft of assumptions, of givens, suddenly drifting away. Will the United States be on the right side of history here? This hour on Point, U.S. foreign policy now in the Arab world. You can join the conversation. How do you judge Washington's response so far to the crisis in Egypt? What does this eruption of change mean for American policy in the region? What's at stake? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Hear gunfire near Tahrir Square last night. And the president at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington this morning, speaking of Egypt.
And we pray that the violence in Egypt will end, and that the rights and aspirations of the Egyptian people will be realized, and that a better day will dawn over Egypt and throughout the world.
We're talking this hour with three top foreign policy experts, including former Undersecretary of State Ambassador Nicholas Burns. But joining us first from Cairo for the latest today is Nicholas Kristof, columnist for the New York Times, who's there in the midst of all of it. Nick Kristof, thanks very much for being here. What's the situation today?
Well, there are still masses of people in Tahrir Square, but it is very difficult now to get inside. The authorities are clamping down. The first entrance where I tried to get in, there were a bunch of these thugs with boards with nails embedded in them, and then they've steadily been actually setting up outer perimeters even further out, and they're also, when they find journalists, they're grabbing them, grabbing their tapes, destroying their cameras. So there's generally an escalation kind of all around. The violence is continuing in the square, but it's perhaps not as bad as it was yesterday.
You say thugs at the entrances to Tahrir Square, but what do you mean by thugs? Who do they represent? Why are they there?
Well, these are, the government has sent them out. This is something that has been kind of standard operating procedure. And they send out these young men with weapons to intimidate, and it's something they've done in the past, just not in front of as many cameras. But, I think sometimes there's a misperception that these are, earnest individuals who are in favor of President Mubarak staying in office. And there are indeed such people, plenty of such people, around Cairo and around Egypt. But they are not the ones who are carrying machetes and clubs. Those people, as far as we can tell, are provocateurs sent by the government to crackheads and do it with some deniability. I've seen a lot of those who were captured, and many of them did have police IDs or IDs from the ruling party.
We saw yesterday, the whole world saw this tide, this ebb and flow of the Mubarak people and the protesters against Mubarak fighting in Tahrir Square. Where does that stand today? Who seems to be dominating? If this is a fight for the future, who's on top today, Nick?
Well, last night at the end of the day, the pro-democracy people ended up, in a sense, winning. Basically, the government thugs, I think they reached the end of their 8-hour workday, and then they went home. That's the problem with mercenaries. While the pro-democracy people were camping out in the square, they've been able to resupply to some degree, and the outpouring of enthusiasm is astonishing. I visited a little field hospital there where 150 doctors have volunteered to work to treat injuries. I talked to one doctor who he saw the images over the TV, and then last night he worked out his will and drove 200 kilometers early this morning to get to Tahrir and to heal those who were injured. So there's a lot of passion and a lot of fervor and determination. just a question of whether that can, you know, that works to some degree against guys with clubs and sticks and stones. It does not work so well against AK-47s.
And the military, are they standing back today, Nicholas Kristof, or are they favoring one side or the other?
The military, in general, I'd say, is largely avoiding getting involved. In some cases, it has moved in to separate the two sides, which is certainly good. In some cases, it shows some sympathy for the pro-democracy protesters. But it's also, to some degree, I mean, in two places, two checkpoints, the military were the people who blocked us from entering Tahrir Square. And then they are also apparently grabbing journalists and destroying their materials, as well as just the police or these goons. So it's, you know, it depends to some degree on the unit and what orders they're getting and whether they're following them.
What do Egyptians that you speak with in the last couple of days, what do they want from the United States now?
There's a strong perception that the U.S. has been, they often talk about in terms of playing games. The U.S. is making these very, very calculated decisions and, you know, is reluctant to part with Mubarak. And so many people still feel that the U.S. is in some form still supporting the idea that Mubarak stay in power until September, and they don't like that. Now, some people go further and say the U.S. should really, you know, push to get Mubarak out. Others say, no, this is Egypt. You know, we don't want the U.S. interfering in our decisions. But mostly they want the U.S., as they see it, to no longer be supporting Mubarak finishing out his term.
Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, joining us there from Cairo. Nick, thank you very much. Be safe.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
I'm just reading a wire report here that two New York Times journalists have been arrested in Egypt, the Associated Press is now reporting. Not Nick Kristof, not at this point anyway. Joining us now, Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during the George W. Bush administration, where he was the country's top negotiator on Iran, former senior advisor to Presidents Clinton and George H.W. Bush on the National Security Council. He spent decades at the heart of American foreign policy creation and execution, now teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador Burns, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
With me in the studio, Stephen Kinzer, longtime award-winning international correspondent for The New York Times with deep experience in the Middle East and beyond, focused closely now lately on this region. His latest book is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Stephen Kinzer, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, Susan Glasser joins us, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Susan Glasser, thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Ambassador Burns, Nick Burns, first to you. What do you see at stake as the whole world, as Americans, watch these images of this conflict in Cairo, in Egypt?
Well, Tom, this is one of the most complicated and complex foreign policy challenges that I can remember, and it just became much more difficult and much more dangerous last evening, given what happened in Tahrir Square. So I think there's a lot at stake for the United States. Egypt is, in my judgment, arguably the most important American partner in the most important region of the world, the greater Middle East. The Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty of 1979 is the foundation of our entire regional policy. If it is abrogated by some future Egyptian government that may follow President Mubarak, all bets are off. And President Mubarak has helped over the last 30 years in the struggle against terrorist groups like al-Qaeda, in the effort to contain Iran, in the effort to keep the Suez Canal open, to help with moderate Palestinians. So there are real benefits to the United States from President Carter, President Reagan, all the way through to President Obama. But here's the dilemma, especially for President Obama. We have to speak and very openly, clearly, to support the reformers, to support democracy, because they want the kind of change that we have a long-term interest in. That's on the one hand. On the other, President Obama needs to engage in quiet diplomacy with President Mubarak to, frankly, ease him out of power, convince this very proud 82-year-old leader to leave, and hopefully, with the military's help, because that's a very important institution in Egyptian society, provide for some kind of transition to a better, more responsible government. This is a very difficult balancing act. My quick judgment, Tom, is that President Obama has acted very skillfully over the last 10 days, but this game has just become much more complicated. I think our government's going to be tested very much so, over the next week or so.
We'll look at much more at Egypt. Susan Glasser, look right across the region for a moment. This is being described as a watershed moment for American policy, a kind of arrangement we've had with authoritarian governments for decades now, including Egypt's. Whatever happens in Egypt, are we at a turning point? Is the gig up on that long era of American posture, policy in this region, Susan?
Well, you know, things have moved so fast and so quickly, it's hard to say where they're going to go next. Certainly no one of us has a crystal ball. I'm thinking back to the beginning of January in a very prescient piece that someone who follows the region very closely wrote, and he said, are we seeing the wages of Arab decay finally coming home to us? The incipient protests, there have been protests before. Why has it taken hold and the spark lit? You look at Jordan, preemptive action by the king there to change the government. Same thing in Yemen. Of course, we've already had what they're calling the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia. I think it does feel like we're at a sort of a pivot point. I think, however, Americans who are riveted by these images of protesters coming to claim their democratic rights, I need to be a little bit sanguine about, A, how long it's going to take for this process to play out, and B, what's the end result going to be? It's going to take years to shake out. Look at the former Soviet Union 2 decades later, and you have a sense that this is not necessarily going to be the days of wine and roses, even if some much-needed change comes to the region.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour as Egypt boils today about U.S. foreign policy and the Arab world. Here, sounds from Cairo. Earlier today, an anti-Mubarak protester on the streets of Cairo expressing her frustration. This is courtesy of Press TV. She says it's our right to express what is within us without being afraid of the army or a policeman locking us away. Enough, she says, it's our right to have change. Here, a member of the Egyptian police in the Cairo protests yesterday talking about his support for Mubarak. This from Al Jazeera.
Please, we are Egyptians. All these people, Egyptians. No foreigners. We like Mubarak. We want Mubarak.
A policeman says, we like Mubarak. Want Mubarak? Here's a female protester explaining why so many women in Cairo are participating in the anti-Mubarak demonstrations earlier today.
We felt like we cannot stay at home while people are dying in the streets because they have a cause. We felt like we have to come here and do whatever we can.
And in Washington, the foreign policy establishment on high alert, a whole era of American foreign policy may be on the line right here, right now. Nicholas Burns joins us today, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, been in the thick of it for a long, long time. Stephen Kinzer is with us, author of Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, longtime former correspondent for The New York Times, and Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Stephen Kinzer, you've been listening, you've been watching with all of us. What do you see unfolding here right now in terms of what's happening and its implications for U.S. foreign policy?
It's nice to see the United States coming out in support of democracy in the Middle East and democracy in Egypt, but that's a very diffuse concept. Sure, what people in Egypt want is an end to corruption and more economic development and an end to political repression. But there's something else that's very important. These regimes that have come under such intense pressure in the Middle East are regimes that support American foreign policy in the Middle East. Fundamentally, they support the idea of accommodating Israel, supporting the settlement project in the West Bank, supporting the embargo on Gaza, and they also support the intense U.S. campaign against Iran. Those policies are immensely unpopular in the Arab world. If there is democracy in Egypt or other countries in that part of the world, those countries are not going to support American policy toward Israel. They are not going to support the American campaign against Iran. So when we are promoting the idea of democracy in the Middle East, we are also promoting the idea that these countries are going to be free to break with some of the most fundamental principles of American foreign policy.
Nicholas Burns, do we have to choose in that case? Is it the anti-Iran campaign by the U.S., the Israel support, or democracy? Is it an either-or?
Well, I don't think it's that simple. I think that we've got to live, we've lived for 30 years with this contradiction in American policy between our hardcore real interests that we all talked about and between our hope that over time the Middle East will join the rest of the world in trying to introduce openness and democratic values in their governance. They're not there yet. And as Susan has said, this is going to be a marathon of a crisis.
But Stephen Kinzer is saying that's a fundamentally flawed combination you've got there, that if you want democracy, it's going to come with opposition to the what has been the American agenda.
No question. And when Hamas won the elections in Gaza, what did the United States do? A government in which I participated, by the way, we walked away from Hamas and said we wouldn't deal with them. I don't think we have the luxury of doing that this time. There are some limits to American influence. It's not all about us. And the Egyptians are going to write this story. So we can't direct events, but we can help to influence them. And here's the challenge. We've got to protect some of those interests that are core to our future in the region. And that is blocking Iran. That is trying to see moderate Palestinians succeed. That is keeping the peace between Egypt and Israel. I think the only way we can do that now in the midst of this crisis in Egypt is to do what President Obama is trying to do, is to give support for a long-range process towards reform and hope that any future Egyptian governments are going to stay with a rather moderate foreign policy line that, frankly, I believe is best for Egypt, but certainly also best for our own country, the U.S.
Susan Glasser, I'll come to you on that, but Stephen Kinzer, can we have it both ways? It's hard to imagine how we would not. Blocking Iran's nuclear program, supporting Israel, these are such bedrock elements of American foreign policy. Are you really suggesting that to support democracy in the Arab world, we have to reconsider those?
It all depends on how you define core interests. Some people would say it's a core interest of the United States to block Iran and campaign against Iran. Others would argue that's not true. We actually should accommodate Iran and try to make a deal with Iran. That would actually calm things in the Middle East.
You mean, have a nuclear weapon, fine by us?
It wouldn't have to go that far, but it would involve serious diplomatic engagement rather than a campaign of nothing but sanctions and demonization and trying to isolate Iran. In addition, some people would argue that it is not a core interest of the United States to support an Israeli government that's continuing with the settlement project in the West Bank and the embargo on Gaza. In fact, you could argue that those policies actually undermine America's position in the Middle East. So the question is, we want to support our core values, but what are really core values? What's really important to us? We need to reevaluate whether some of the policies we've been following in the Middle East actually undermine our long-term security interests.
Susan Glasser, how do you define America's core interests in this region? 1, 2, 3, what are they?
Well, first of all, I think we've been stuck in the trap of believing this is an either-or. I wanted to circle back to that because I think that's really at the heart of what's happening right now. In a way, isn't that what President Mubarak has been using as the sort of threat to keep Americans engaged with him over the long term? He's presented it as a choice between him and an untrammeled democracy that is going to be irrevocably opposed to American interests in the region. I think that's a very open question. As Nick Burns pointed out, is a new Egyptian government, regardless of which part of the political spectrum it comes from, are they going to pursue war with Israel at this point? I mean, they presumably do have some national interests of their own in stability in their neighborhood, after all. And I think clearly it's also true that President Mubarak hasn't exactly gone out of his way to foster a new kind of peace with the Palestinians and the Israelis. So arguably, he's also been performing a balancing act over these last few decades. So it's much, much less clear than those on either side of this conversation would have it. So I think that's part of the problem. But clearly, we're moving toward a new assessment of what are the American national interests in the region, really. I think there is a broad consensus across the American political spectrum that the distastefulness of holding our noses and supporting these really heavy-handed autocrats
for a long, long, long time.
This is not compatible with American values. Whether it is compatible with American interests in the future is something that will be seen.
Stephen Kinzer, Susan Glasser says it doesn't have to be either or. It's not. We can thread this needle, support democracy and stand by America's long-term interests here.
Our biggest challenge is to re-examine and redefine what our interests in the Middle East really are. We have been pursuing interests that have required us to impose autocratic leaders in much of the Middle East. Once we begin to reassess those interests, that becomes less necessary. But that requires the kind of fundamental reset and rethink of American foreign policy that we're not good at. Figuring out a whole new approach to a very crucial part of the world is something that America is not good at doing.
I want to talk about what that might be. here was President Obama. This was on Tuesday night before things got really ugly the next day, talking about change in Egypt, saying it must begin now. That did not go down well with Cairo, with the Mubarak government, but here's the American president.
It is not the role of any other country to determine Egypt's leaders. Only the Egyptian people can do that. What is clear, and what I indicated tonight to President Mubarak, is my belief that an orderly transition must be meaningful, it must be peaceful, and it must begin now.
And the next morning, Mubarak sent supporters into the streets with those sticks with nails in them we heard about to go after the protesters. Here's John McCain on CBS's The Early Show this morning. Republican Arizona Senator John McCain saying that he thinks Mubarak must go.
I realize this is fraught with danger. I realize the influence of extremist organizations as well as the Muslim Brotherhood. But I don't think the status quo is something that could lead to anything but much more violence.
Senator John McCain this morning, Stephen Kinzer, Susan Glasser, Ambassador Nicholas Burns are with us. Let's go to our callers. Azita in New York City. You're on the air, Azita.
Hi, Tom. I don't want to take so much time. I just wanted to say that we cannot, as this country who is always talking about human rights and freedom and justice and democracy, support such a regime, a criminal regime, that brutally kills, tortures, and murders its own citizens.
Azita, you say we cannot do it, but we have done it already for 30 years. We've done it.
Yes, exactly. But I'm saying then we cannot talk about human rights and justice and freedom. And we need to support the people in Iran. There were no foreign journalists in 2009 in Iran. Everything that was coming out was you know via the people in the streets with cell phones, and you saw what happened. The government, the thugs of the government, were slaughtering people in the streets, and yet the United States still wants to deal with this government who supports terrorism all over the world. Who
supports terrorism? We'll look at that. Nicholas Burns, you hear that? You know that it's a lot of people are drawn to a flat judgment call these days, a moral judgment, and it's easy to understand. Saying we cannot support a regime like this, and yet the U.S. has, for reasons that you have more than alluded to, you've laid out. Where does it put us now?
Well, I think it puts picture President Obama high up on a wire without a net. Mm-hmm. And trying to balance these competing objectives that we've all been talking about. There is something extraordinary, on the one hand, happening in the Arab world. There is a movement for reform. It's led by young people, and many of them quite idealistic, and almost all of them peaceful, from Tunis to Sana'a to Cairo. We have to support that movement for the long term because of our national values and because that's where this region may be heading. But in the meantime, the marathon route to get there is going to be torturous, and we have other real interests that we cannot disregard, that we've got to continue to safeguard. And I just say to Stephen, whom I respect very much, take Iran, for instance. If Egypt can help us to contain Iran, that helps us to avoid a war with Iran. Containment meaning bottle them up, use diplomacy, use sanctions to prevent Iran from dominating the Middle East. But let's not start a third war in the Middle East. I think if we don't have the Arab partners to contain Iran, we're more likely, unfortunately, to get into a hot conflict with Iran, which none of us should want. So these are very real interests. I see, Tom, no alternative for President Obama than to keep balancing these competing interests.
But Steve Kinzer's point is that we're efforting, as they say in Washington, an unsustainable balance. That there's sort of facts on the ground going forward that may not support the old balance. How much can it move, Nick Burns?
The reality of government, of course, and of international politics is that you have to deal with the world as it's given to you, not as you wish it to be. And we have inherited, over the last 10 days, the most extraordinary, most difficult, complex set of issues that one can imagine. And it's not trending in a positive direction. So I do think it's important for the United States to play this role of putting out, as President Obama has done, I think pretty effectively, these aspirations for change, and yet using the influence that we still have, and we're by far the most influential foreign country involved, to nudge President Mubarak out of power. I agree with Senator McCain. And to try to see if the army, the central institution in Egypt, might then permit and protect a transitional period where people, responsible people like Mohammed al-Baradei or others, can come forward to try to piece together a road ahead. I don't see it as any more simple than that. It is going to be very, very difficult.
Let's get a call from Mudafa here, Norwood, Massachusetts. Mudafa, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I have 2 points to state. I think the discussion is on the wrong track in terms of the Egypt influence and the relation to Israel. I think if the change happened, Israel, the peace, the prospect for peace will be more reasonable or more seeable. And the reason is, for decades, Israel side up Egypt from any conflicts against the Palestinian, against the against Lebanon. Therefore, Israel did not see any political consequences for their act, and they reject the peace process all these years in a way or another. So my point is, if change happened, United States will have more leverage in pushing Israel to accept a peace deal. And second, Israel will think it twice before they reject all the peace proposal which has been submitted.
Mudafa, let us look at that. Stephen Kinzer, let's say there's a post-Mubarak government in. It has the Muslim Brotherhood as part of some kind of coalition that would seem inevitable. Some warn that could mean even war between Israel and Egypt. Mudafa says, no, it could be the other dynamic. It may open a way to an actual peace, not this peace process that never goes anywhere. What do you see?
I agree. I don't think the confrontational approach that the U.S. has in many ways encouraged in the Middle East is popular among the Arab street. It's true that Obama can't simply take a guy who's been licking our boots for 30 years and suddenly throw him under the bus. But there's a larger problem.
Isn't that
here.
What's going on? Isn't that what you're suggesting?
I think Obama's handling it well. He's
yeah,
doing
but he's saying now, start now. And
start
John McCain
now.
Is saying get out, not just start, but get out. Ambassador Burns essentially saying he agrees with John McCain, time to go. He says nudge, that's not throwing under the bus, but for Hosni Mubarak, if you say go, that's under the bus.
There's a larger question here, and it's not just to do with Egypt or even just to do with the Middle East. What the United States looks for in the world is leaders who fulfill two qualifications. On the one hand, we want leaders who are popular, who have the support of their people. On the other hand, we want leaders who are going to support our foreign policy principles. But soon, as we're seeing in Egypt now, you have to realize you can't have both, because most of the foreign policy principles that the United States is pursuing in the Middle East are deeply unpopular with the people of
Do we have to fundamentally realign those foreign policy principles, or can we just hang in there, you know, muddle through as hard as it may be, as Nick Burns says, and hang on to the agenda that we've got?
I go with the former. We must fundamentally realign.
With what in that case? Susan, yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to jump in. Actually, I think the caller made a very interesting and important point. Mm-hmm. I think that we are wrong if we assume that we know what the outcome is going to be and what the blowback on the United States is going to be. I think there are substantial questions about whether the Israelis might at some point feel much more driven toward a genuine peace process, toward the contours of a deal that have long since been available to them and have presented themselves. So yeah, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think it's important to think that there's so many actors right now who are reevaluating their positions, and part of what's happened here is the increase of volatility in the region. And that means that it's more unknowable what's going to happen. And I just wouldn't discount the potential that there's more urgency to drive some of these longtime feuding parties to the table now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy and the Arab world as Egypt boils. Hear those clashing demonstrators yesterday in Cairo's Tahrir Square. And here, President Obama speaking on Tuesday, saying the United States stands behind the right of the Egyptian people to protest.
Throughout this process, the United States will continue to extend the hand of partnership and friendship to Egypt. And we stand ready to provide any assistance that is necessary to help the Egyptian people as they manage the aftermath of these protests.
The aftermath, nobody knows yet just how big an aftermath, how deep or consequential it's going to be, but it feels like a pivotal moment for the region and therefore U.S. foreign policy there. Ambassador Nicholas Burns joins us today, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs until 2008, decades at the heart of U.S. foreign policy creation and execution. Stephen Kinzer is with us, longtime former New York Times correspondent, author of most lately Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Susan Glasser is with us from Washington, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Lots of comments here on Facebook. Rick says, we need to keep our involvement to an absolute minimum. Nick Burns, how much can the U.S. just be hands-off in this era? Can it step back, or is it so bound up with these regimes, whether it's Jordan or Yemen or Egypt, that it is inevitably in the middle of what unfolds here?
We can't separate ourselves from events in the Middle East because American national interests are at stake there, not just the national interests of countries in the region. So we've got to be involved. And the trick will be this. Can we avoid megaphone diplomacy? Can we avoid having our president make the story all about the United States? I think President Obama, in this game of multidimensional chess, has done pretty well because he hasn't injected the United States directly into Tahrir Square, but he's exercising influence behind the scenes. He's making the statements, Tom, that you've played on this show that are helping to chart where this drama might head. So it would be easier to say, let's just wash our hands of it and let the Egyptians figure this out. But there's a problem here. There's a drama in Egypt, which is highly complex. There's a drama in the Arab world, which is the overlay. And the United States, for 50, 60 years, our vital national interests, what truly matters to us, is tied up in that region. So we have to stay engaged.
Do you really think that we can, however complex, we can muddle through to, if the tide sweeps toward democracy in these countries, can we sustain our current agenda and be on the side of those democracies?
I hope we can, but I can't. None of us can know for sure because,
it's
we may be...
It's a pretty big deal, right? I mean, that's a pretty massive question if it goes
it
that
is.
Way.
It is. And, Tom, we may be a day 10 of a 1,000-day crisis or a 10,000-day crisis. And so what we've got to do is keep our wits and hold true to our values and express them, as President Obama mm-hmm. has done, but then behind the scenes try to use our influence to preach moderation, peaceful change, maintenance of Egypt at peace with Israel, Egypt trying to resist Iran. These are huge American stakes, and we just can't give up. And we've got to do the best we can in an almost impossible situation.
Also, a big question whether our behind-the-scenes efforts will be interpreted that way, in favor of moderation, peaceful change. The Tehran Times headlines, American generals show up in Cairo to, I forget what it was exactly, but like to confab with Mubarak's people. Ben in New York. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show. Just two quick points. I think this is a complex situation. People, obviously not your guests, are forgetting that. It's critical to remember that while, Mubarak has certainly been a repressive leader, he has preserved the peace with Israel and has
yes.
been a key U.S. ally in the war on terror, which for the immediate period after 9/11 seemed our priority. I mean, if remember.
Right, sure.
Saying, with you were with us or you're against us. That was our message. So I think it's a situation where we, sort of want to have our cake and eat it too. And that's it's a little bit unfair to say, to Mubarak, get out. At the same time, this also serves as a reminder of what Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer warned us about in their paper, The Israel Lobby, I remember reading in college, about like the consequences of having, sort of an unbalanced relationship with Israel. And I'm half Jewish, and so this isn't a case where I'm anti-Israel, but I think that their paper is especially relevant.
But Ben, if the people of Egypt are saying, government, get out, should the United States not be on their side, or do we have to, tiptoe?
Well, I think we certainly have to tiptoe, Tom, because, Mubarak's been a close ally of us, and it's great that we're, all for democracy now. But like I said, after 9/11, we were sending people over to Egypt to be renditioned. I think that that's Most people see that as, something we did.
Yeah, Ben, I appreciate your call very much. Stephen Kinzer, I mean, on the defending Mubarak side, you've got critics, certainly in Israel, saying here's the U.S. just throwing a long-time rock-solid ally overboard, under the bus, as you say. I mean, how many, these have been American allies at the top of these countries, no matter how unpopular. How many alliances can we walk away from, or are you saying we have to remake them all?
I agree that you can't immediately break with people that you don't like if you've been supporting them for many, many years. That sends a bad message, and it's not good for the United States in the long run. On the other hand, we have to understand that we are now identified with the settlement project in the West Bank, the embargo on Gaza, and a campaign against Iran that's highly unpopular in the Middle East. It's true. We need to find ways to coax both Israel and Iran out of their isolation and their anger and their paranoia. But are the policies we're now following effective in doing that? I think most people in the Arab world and those people that are out in the streets in Cairo today would tell you no.
So what's the agenda that would align with what's emerging in the Arab world now in the streets and with American interests? Is there an agenda that can cover both, Stephen, in your view?
The best model, the best thing we could hope for as an outcome in Egypt would be that Egypt would emerge something like an Arab version of Turkey. What do we have in Turkey? You have a democratic government. It has a religious tint to it, but it tolerates secularism. It has a booming capitalist economy. It's primarily sympathetic to the United States and Europe, but it is militantly opposed to American policy toward Israel and militantly opposed to American policy toward Iran. That's the best outcome we could hope for in Egypt.
So, Nicholas Burns, can the United States live with a country that is, whatever else, however else, everything else may be, that is militantly opposed to American policy on Israel?
I don't think we should settle for that. I don't think we have to settle for that.
Even if it was all these other things, you know, it was just tinged with Islamism, but not an Islamic government, that it had robust capitalism, that it had democracy. Can a militant anti-Israel position be managed somehow?
There's a long, long way between Turkey and Egypt. Turkey, with its democratic traditions going back decades. Egypt, mm-hmm. No democratic traditions, run by three generals since 1952.
Well, we supported Nasser, that Sadat, setup Mubarak. For most of that time.
We did, but that just explains the point mm-hmm. that I'm trying to make, and mm-hmm. that is that we've got to be very, very careful here to also stand up for what our interests are. Our interests are in seeing Iran contained. Our interests are in seeing Israel survive and at peace with Israel. And we shouldn't be bashful in saying to President Mubarak or his successors, this is the kind of Middle East that we want. This is what we hope you'll stand for. We should work for that. It's going to have to be largely behind the scenes, but there isn't public aspect to this. We've got to be consistent and not deviate from decades of American interests.
I think it's true that we need to guarantee the long-term security of Israel, and we need to try to find a way to contain Iran. But the question is, are our present policies doing that, or are they undermining those long-term goals?
Sarah, in Brattleboro, Vermont. Sarah, you're on the air. Susan, I'll come right to you. Sarah in Vermont, you're on.
Hi, Tom. That actually leads perfectly into my point that supporting Israel in the long term is not in our best interest.
Why?
I actually lived in the West Bank for 3 years and in Egypt for 6 months. And I just really think that our support of Israel and our demonization of Iran and our crutching up of these horrible dictators is ultimately what is going to create more terrorism and more anger against us and more unwillingness to work with the United States.
Yeah, but can the United States just start cutting loose anything willy-nilly anywhere? Cut loose Israel? You're saying in the long term that's not in American interest? You'd cut it loose?
I wouldn't cut it loose, but I think that if we support the pro-democracy movements right now, they will remember that we supported them and they will be our new long-term allies. And even if that means that they're not going to support our unquestioning support of Israel or our complete demonization of Iran, they will support whatever the new policy will be.
So I appreciate your call, Sarah. Susan Glasser, how does the U.S. position itself to support the democratic movements we're seeing in the streets? We hope that's what they are. And to sustain its long-term alliances here, including Israel.
Well, I think that pretty much is the dilemma right now. The caller expressed sort of the most optimistic possible scenario, which is if we offer support now for these young Democrats in the street, they'll remember us in the long term. I guess I would suggest that's fraught for a number of reasons. First of all, we don't know who's going to emerge in the leadership of a new Egypt. And just because the initial protests have been driven by not the Muslim Brotherhood and a much more broad-based, young, Western-oriented, or at least democratic student movement does not mean that that's who's going to emerge ultimately in power in Egypt. And I think we've talked very little about that in the last hour, and that's a key question for us. We don't know who the interlocutors are, so it's very, very hard to sort of even game out what the strategic consequences are going to be, number one.
It's clearly not all ours at all to decide, ultimately, or not in this new era anyway, it appears. Doug in Nashville, you're on the air, Doug.
Hi. My comment is this. I just find it somewhat mind-boggling that the discussion between the academics is whether it's in the best interest of the United States or the best interest of Israel. I think too many foreign policy decisions by the United States are made in the interest of what's best for Israel. What about, first, what's best for the people of Egypt? This seems a clear case where, once again, like Tarillo and the Dominican Republic, the Shah in Iran, you can go on and on and on, where we seem to buy off a dictator and are shocked when the people get tired of it. It's a wonder that any democratically elected country in the world would put up with the duplicity and contradictions of American foreign policy. We say one thing and do another. And as far as Iran and the nuclear dilemma, why should Israel be allowed to possess nuclear weapons and not Iran? If Iran doesn't have them, then why doesn't Israel disarm?
Doug, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Burns, how do you respond? Can the U.S. be lined up with what's best for the people of Egypt? That's 80 million people. That's a lot of people. And sustain its other traditional strategic goals?
Well, this is why I think that President Obama is right to support these reformers, to support change, to support a road towards democracy. He's put us out there, the United States of America, in the last 10 days. He's right to do it. Senator McCain agrees with him, as far as I can see. So we have some bipartisan consensus here. And I would just say to the caller, there's a vast difference between the Israeli and Iranian governments. Israel is a democracy and a responsible power. We have some disagreements with it. Certainly I do on the settlement policy in the West Bank. The Iranian government, completely irresponsible. And I can tell you, no matter which government emerges in Egypt in the future, I'll bet that government will not support a close relationship with Iran. Hardly any of the Arab governments do, because they fear this revolution from Iran. So we're dealing with highly complex issues. And I do think our president has got us facing in the right direction. Now we just got to put our seatbelts on and hope that we can manage this crisis effectively.
The same questions emerge, but is it a balance we can sustain, Stephen? And, Ambassador Burns says Iran completely irresponsible, yet you're suggesting a kind of a reassessment of Iran, maybe even an alliance with Iran. How do these pieces fit together?
Iran is a big power in the Middle East. It's always going to be. When you look at a map of the Middle East, it jumps right out at you. Iran is the big country right in the middle. Yet we are following a policy of confrontation and sanctioning rather than seriously trying to engage Iran. And I don't believe that you're going to see necessarily a government emerging in Egypt that's going to be supporting the U.S. confrontational policy with Iran. Those WikiLeaks that we kept seeing, all the denunciations that you heard of Iran, cut off the head of the snake, those are coming from the old Arab leadership clique. That's the exact clique that people are rebelling against. And I think most people in the Middle East would like to see the U.S. do what Turkey would like to see the U.S. do with Iran, which is ratchet down the confrontational rhetoric and make a serious negotiating effort and try to bring Iran out of the cold rather than simply confronting it and demonizing it.
Jolie Steve, and Tiffin. Nicholas, sorry. Yes.
Excuse me, Tom. I just wanted to say, Steve, that's exactly what President Obama's tried to do. He's reached out.
I totally disagree.
Said,
he has not done
that
at all.
The Iranians have said, not interested.
No, that's not true. He has not reached out. We have not made a serious effort to engage
Iran. It looked like
it.
We were told for the first year of his administration that's what we were up to.
We have only insisted that Iran negotiate on the one issue that we care about, which is the nuclear issue. We refuse to broaden the agenda to include issues that Iran cares about.
Jolie and Tiffin, Iowa. Jolie, you're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to suggest that your callers seem to get it, although I'm not sure that you people do. It's American foreign policy that needs to change much more than Egyptian policy. because unfortunately American foreign policy is steal, grab, invade, dominate, and we don't give a damn about human rights except in communist countries.
Jolie, I appreciate your call. Susan, how much do you expect American foreign policy to change in the face of this wave, apparently, that we're seeing in the Arab world right now?
I think the bottom line is it's going to change a lot, number one. Number two, we talked about WikiLeaks. The unsustainability, I think, of this enormous contradiction between our private assessment and our values as a country and some of the people that we're supporting and some of the national interests that we've defined are going to look increasingly unsustainable at this moment in the Arab world. Thirdly, just quickly to go back to this Iran conversation between Stephen and Nick, I'm struck by this. How can we be, on the one hand, advocating for more engagement and ratcheting down confrontation and negotiations with Iran, which also, by the way, is the kind of brutal dictatorship that we're talking about toppling elsewhere across the Middle East?
So much to follow. Nick Burns, is it possible that we'll end up on the outside looking in? It's not ours to decide ultimately in Egypt. Could we end up with a government there? We've just got half a minute, Nick, but that just doesn't want to talk to Washington. Or does $1.5 billion in annual aid mean that won't happen?
Well, we've seen it before. We saw Iran cut off relations with the United States for 30 years because of some American and Iranian mistakes 30 years ago. I think we're seeing President Obama, from his inauguration on, trying to realign the American presence. I think that direction is where we should go to.
A lot up in the air as Egyptians are up in arms in the streets right now. We're grateful to all three of you. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the U.S. State Department. Thank you very much, Nick Burns. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Susan Glasser, Editor-in-Chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, joining us from Washington. Susan, thank you for your insights.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.
And Stephen Kinzer, author of Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Stephen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for keeping it lively.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We look for your comments at our website, onpointradio.org, at Twitter, at Facebook, at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.